Good evening, Woodstock. Yeah. My name is Damon. I am an alcoholic. Amen. My sobriety date is October. Excuse me. That's my wedding day. We just had 42 years just this past October. Well, I don't know. I like the guy who said we never decided to divorce each other at the same time. But my sobriety date is August the 10th of 2004. So it's 17 years. Save everybody the math there. Angel, thank you for inviting me. Although I'll tell you what, it was a tough call because this afternoon my 10-year-old grandson said, "Do you want to play a board game?" And I was like, you know, I'm going to give you guys a warning up front, okay? I've heard some people say that they love to hear where an old timer suffers and they go through this and they use this program to get out. I'm sorry, that's not my story. When I came in here, I had a guy named Pat Hilton. I don't know how anybody knew Pat Hilton or whatever. And his first sponsor, he got sober. He died with 35 years sober. He got sober out in Los Angeles with Chuck Chamberlain and Clancy Emerson and a gal named Alabama Carruthers. But his first sponsor, he said, was a woman. He said he called it Hallmark because he always wanted the very best. You know, so it was one of the most amazing women he'd ever meet, people in general that he'd ever met. And on her desk, she said, "Life is in session. Are you present?" You know, and you know what he told me when I came in? He said, "I've never had a bad day in AA. I've had bad moments and they were all my fault, but I've never had a bad day." And I can honestly tell you, I haven't had a bad day in AA. I'm going to tell you some things about things that have happened. I've had circumstances that have happened in my life, but I haven't had a bad day. I tell you sometimes, you ever just look at your hand? Take a look at your hand. Isn't that a damn useful thing? Isn't that incredible? Now, what did I have to do to get that? You know, I was out. You know, this is that thing. I'm a guy who... I was born in 1955, so I'm coming up on 66 years old this next month. And I grew up in Atlanta. I was in East Point down there. And my dad got a traveling job, and he could earn a little more money. And we moved up off Cherry Mill Road up there. And I was at Micro Center today, and the guy was asking me about the history. I said, "I remember when this was woods. We used to wander around. I remember when Delk Road was dirt." Anybody else? Yeah, that, it was a little dirt path you went through there. And, but I'll tell you what, we had a great time, you know. When I was in third grade, I was in elementary school and, they give the kids Ritalin now. Back then they gave us Paddlin. It's similar result, I think, but I got Paddlin a couple of times and my mom, they sent me to a child psychologist, and she said, "Well, he's bored." And my parents, now he had this traveling job, but I'll tell you what, they strained and stretched the budget in order to send me to a private school. I went down to Pace Academy off West Paces Ferry Road down there from 5th grade to 12th grade. Is anybody familiar with the Fifth Traditions group in Atlanta? You know Robert Bell? Yeah, he and I went to school together. It was funny because Robert, he had straight A's when he was there. And I found out that son of a gun, he went to prison, in jail more times than I did, you know, coming in. He's just an overachiever when it comes to life, you know. But I'll tell you what, has anybody else here been told that you had a lot of potential if you only applied yourself? I see some identification out there. Well, I was a C student for a lot of it. But I'll tell you the other thing. Is one of the, I guess, the remaining little glimpse of a resentment I have that every now and then comes out in ways I could have smashed his windshield. The other one that came to me the other day is I could have put sand in his gas tank of that high performance car he had when at 16 years old. You know, I tell you what, I tell you right now, I am not responsible for what I think. I'm damn sure responsible for how long I think it. And that was told to me coming in here too. I am damn sure responsible. In fact, I have this concept called loaded words. Okay? Like pissed off. You know, pissed off's a very interesting phrase, don't you think? Have you ever seen Robin Hood Men in Tights? And he goes, it sounds more like pissed on than pissed off, you know. But what it is I turn off my ability to urinate, and I just fill up with all this stuff, you know. And even then, I'm proud. I'm pissed off. So I don't use that word. How about this? How would you like to get rid of all your problems that quick? I'm serious. Would you like to get rid of all your problems that quick? In fact, I talked to one lady. She says, no, I kind of like my problems. I said, okay, fine. But do you want, I'm serious. You ready? Rename them situations. Now, is that inaccurate? Is it inaccurate that's a situation? See, my problem, Bill talks about insanity being a lack of proportion. And when I got my problems are this big, rest of the universe, the fact that I have a hand. How many ancestors do you have? Depending on what you believe, I kind of like the idea of a chemical reaction been going on for 3.5 billion years, uninterrupted. Now, what did I have to do with that? This one guy said, to know reality, you must be astonished. And you know what, for me, when I was out there drinking, let me tell you what happened with me. I'm a child of the 60s, so at 8 years old, I was sniffing glue. And at six years old, I was smoking cigarettes. And with Earl Milliron, you know, behind my house, and I'd get caught all the time, but I'd keep go back there. And if we didn't have cigarettes, we'd roll rabbit tobacco, smoke that. 6 years old. At 8 years old, sniff glue. My sister turned me on to marijuana at 10 as a step up. And we got drunk for the first time at 12 years old. We put, anybody else go to the various liquor cabinets of the dads and you put all the clear stuff we put in a Sprite bottle and the color stuff we put in a Coke bottle. And we went out and to make sure we didn't get in trouble, we drank it all. That's interesting thinking, don't you think? So we're stumbling back and I'll get back to the house. My mom's gone for one of those rare times she's gone. And sister comes home and I'm sick, you know, all of there. Well, anyway, she tells my mom I had the flu, so I get to stay home from school the next day. You know, and a lot of people say that this program, in a lot of ways, the drinking is fun. And then fun with some consequences. And then at the end, nothing but consequences. But for me, what happened was when I was 15 years old, I was with one of those hippies down there. A guy named David Perkins. He was the brother of one of the gals that lived there in the neighborhood. He said to me, he said, is it a coincidence you're a Christian in a Christian country? If it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? 15 years old. I went, that's an interesting question. I mean, if I was born in Saudi Arabia, I'd be Islam. If I was born in India, I'd be Sikh or Hindu or Muslim or Buddhist or whatever, you know. And that was an interesting question. Then around that same time, I went up on Kennesaw Mountain, and I couldn't tell the curve of the earth. You ever been up there? And I thought, boy, this is a big place. I wonder what's on the other side. And that sort of planted a seed. Well, my parents ran away from home when I was 17 and moved to Alabama to a lake down there. And they had a room for me down there, but it's a town of 2,000. And I used to hitchhike down to downtown Atlanta and wander around the skyscrapers, you know. It wasn't real appealing going. I was the bottom of the rung at this private school. One particular guy made it his life's, you know, pleasure to, you know, to bully me through that period. And so I was the one isolated out. But yet back in the neighborhood, I was one of the first ones there. We had a 3-story tree hut. At third top floor had a spinner in it for spin the bottle. Not only we ever used it for that, but we were hopeful. We had a parking deck for bicycles, and Russell Bryson, in fact, we had him test it, you know, and he pulls up, goes right off the other end, and he's in this crumpled heap on the other side, and we go, hey, Russell, you okay? Yeah. He says, I think we need a rail. I said, good. That's right. Let's build a rail. So that's kind of what, and I had this dichotomy, you know, the alcoholic leads a double life kind of thing. I had a double life thing going on there. Well, anyway, when they left, I decided, my sister worked for a temp agency, and I wound up shredding documents for Blue Cross Blue Shield, and I just made a game of it. I don't know, I always had a pretty good work ethic, you know. And I'm grateful for all those things my parents gave me. I'm not one that came from, I have no excuse in my family for that. We have a very tight family, good family roots. Man, my grandmother was alcoholic, but she was delightfully alcoholic. She did her, what she did is she took her Smirnoff, or no, she had, what was it? It was the, she took her 7-Up, and then she had her Stillbrook bourbon, that's what it was. And she started out with a jigger, and she'd put the jigger in that, and then she'd fill it up the rest of the way with 7-Up, right? She'd drink it halfway down and fill it up with Stillbrook. Then she'd drink it halfway down and fill it up with Stillbrook. But she was one of these, they talk about different kinds of drunks. Have you ever heard that? There's bellicose, you know, the noisy. There's lachrymose, the crying, you know. There's acrimose, the fighter, you know, and everything. And that's what she was. She just got pleasant that way and just, you know, but that, you know, for me, my parents, my dad, when I was 6 years old, when he took that traveling job, he asked me it was okay for him to travel 2 and 3 weeks at a time. I still remember that. I was a part of that family. And yet, I still wind up drinking like a pig. You know? For me, the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic is the effect that I like the effect produced by alcohol. And I think in some ways, when I take drug alcohol in me, I feel in control. And I talk, and for people who do not drink alcoholically, they feel out of control. And I'll tell you, I've been both, because here's what happened with me. I worked there for a year at Blue Cross Blue Shield. And I decided, you know, as I was delivering mail around there and all that, that it might not be a good, you know, it might not be a bad idea to get a college education. I made a decision. And I went back down, and I could only get into junior college in Alabama, but I pulled a 4.0 there. Because it kind of was an extension of Alabama high school, you know, at that. But I did the work. And also, I had quit smoking weed at that time. And the circle disappeared, but there was a couple people left. You know, and they were the ones that were the real friends. And so I applied myself there. And then my parents said, well, you can go just about anywhere. And I wanted to go for higher education, which meant Colorado. By the way, welcome. I met my wife in Fort Collins, Colorado, at going to Colorado State. I love Colorado in the spring and summer. The winter is fine, but spring and summer, you go up over the Continental Divide, hiking up over there. Yeah. Good times. And I'll tell you what, I was not drinking alcoholically. I'm not one who drank alcoholically during the 80s. When I was going to school, but I tell you what I did, I was taking Chinese history and philosophy in India and studying that other side, because my intention was to learn Chinese language somewhat and then go over and teach English in China in the 70s. Well, I had this idea that China was going to be a big thing. It was hard to miss. You got most of the population of the world sitting there. You've got, you know, all these resources that are there. They've got a tremendous amount of resources. It's the only thing holding them back was their government, you know, at the time. And some history. Well, anyway, I met my wife there, and she was taken, she's an occupational therapist. And shortly after I met her, she came home from class and she had burn holes in her jeans from welding. She had stains on her fingers from woodworking, and she smelled of formaldehyde because they were dissecting a corpse in the anatomy class. And I thought, this is an interesting lady. And let me tell you, it's been really neat. Yes, she is a very interesting lady. And we had sort of a magical summer at that time. And I continued to do well. I was took a year of Chinese language. I was uncertain where I was going with all this. And so she went on her residency down in Baylor, Texas, and I started working in a nursing home for about a year and a half. And let me tell you what, you take people that are 94 years old and they're looking back on their lives, you know, this one couple was married 75 years. She was 15 and he was 16, Nebraska farmers. And I'll tell you what, I saw some families who handled it well, and I saw some families who didn't handle it well. And I got a lot out of that whole thing, and it carried me for probably 10 years or more. You know? And my son was born in 84. We came back to Atlanta because my wife loves things that grow. And, you know, things grow pretty well down here. In Colorado, you got to really nurture them to get. But down here, she loved that idea. And besides, that's an occupational therapy school, so it was pretty well loaded there, so she could find work down here. And we moved down here in 79 once we got married. And I took a year to get residency again back in Georgia, even having grown up here. And then I started going to Georgia State. It was funny, I finished up my undergraduate degree in history, and I'd taken a couple of computer courses to get ready to go into international business. And they said, we have a problem. And I said, what's that? And they said, we can't test you in Chinese. Well, my first thought was, you're going to have to, I don't remember enough Chinese to be tested. And I didn't say that. I said, yes, you have a problem. And they said, wait a minute, you've had Fortran. I said, that's a computer language. They said, yeah, but it's spoken all over the world. So I have an undergraduate degree in history with a specialty in India and China, and my foreign language is Fortran. But as it turns out, my history background was very well suited for programming, because programming really is the history of data moving through a system. It's how people interact with it. It's how they use different resources. And I just clicked right in with it. And the International Business Department was on the same floor as the Marketing Department. And there was an American Marketing Association, had a president, nobody else. And I said, well, the liaison, it looked pretty good. You work with the professional chapter. Well, all of a sudden I saw the professional chapter is required to work with the collegiate chapter. So I started bringing in speakers. And all of a sudden we went from nothing to 75 members, and we were having these lunch meetings and doing all this and had a good time. And what happened was one of the professors was having me type in all the stuff for the statistics, and he wound up getting me a job with the Division of Equifax, who made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And I stopped school for a year just because once I started back up again, they were going to pay for it all. And so I switched over, and I have my master's in marketing and marketing research. And I stayed in there for a dozen years. And towards the end of that, see, I was an optimist. I think you can tell that a little bit, right? I like that story of the little boy they put into a room full of horse manure. Have you ever heard that story? And they put him in this room full of horse manure, and he's just digging away and laughing and digging. And they ask him, what's going on? He says, with all this horse manure, there must be a pony in here somewhere. You know, and that's kind of how I was, because my mom said my life landed jelly side up, you know, in so many different ways. And but here's what happened is I started going from being an optimist to being a pessimist. I started thinking about what was wrong with my life, what was wrong with my wife, what was wrong with my job. And one of the guys that worked for me getting married, so we had a bachelor party, and they went to a belly dancing thing, and then they went to a strip joint afterwards. Well, when I was 6 years old, I had a pull your pants down club with a girl down the street, and we were the only two members. So that had been a long part of my story. And I thought, well, this is a pull your pants down club, you know. And then I was working late on a program and kind of tired, and I said, I think I'll go get a massage, you know. And I thought I was just going to get a massage. And she offered me the full treatment, and I accepted it. And let me tell you what began to happen right then. Because I was thinking about all these things, you know, I'm not getting at home, not all this. But I'll tell you what, Mama raised me better than that. And let me tell you what, when I look at alcohol, I started drinking alcohol for a purpose. I was no longer recreational. We talk about our drinking careers. Bill talks about that several places. And I started drinking to cover up that guilt. Anybody else get pleasure by sneaking around? You know, and there was a lot of that thrill was just sneaking around. You know, my definition of success at that time was, you ready? I got away with it again. That was my definition of success. Anybody else have one like that? You know? But I'll tell you what, I was pretty good because I didn't get caught. Really. Now, I did one time. I got a DUI, one DUI in Atlanta, had a half a fifth of Courvoisier in me and another half underneath the seat. And I spent one night in jail. But I tell you what, when I got out of that, I said, I'm quitting, you know. And I was tears and everything, and I'm in it. And 6 months later, I was drinking again. Let me make a point here. This is not a program for quitters. Whatever you're doing, do not quit drinking. Do not quit drinking. It doesn't work. What I wound up doing is I wound up starting. And I'll explain how that happened. So I started going through this deal where I would quit drinking for a while. And then I'd start feeling a little bit restless, little bit irritable, little bit discontent, just like a pressure cooker, building up, building up. And then I changed my mind about not drinking. And then it worked good. Day, 2 days. A week later, I'm drinking a fifth of vodka a day. Sometimes I'd go 2-3 months at a time. Well, here I'd started, I wound up getting a really good job with, just before all of this alcoholic drinking, I got a job working for HP in their outsourcing division. And I mean, I was doing technical sales stuff, so we were flying around to different places. And so I was out and about again, you know, and I could sneak around at night in different towns. Got away with it again. Well, anyway, I'm back. I got a call from my boss in April of 2001. And he said, one of the customers said they smelled booze on your breath around their multi-million dollars worth of equipment in our data center. I mean, it's the data center I helped build out. I designed the thing. And I denied it. And I said, it might be some medication I've been on, you know. And I quit drinking. And I put on the afterburners, you know. But they put me on probation. Well, anybody else done that where you quit drinking and you put on the afterburners and you start getting accolades and all the things start working great? Well, in August, the CEO laid off everybody in the company that was on probation. And I told him just before I left, I was packing up my stuff, I'm going to be a millionaire next year. You just watch. I'll tell you what, I'm a millionaire many times over right now in an entirely different currency. You see, I didn't want the things the money would buy. I wanted the quality of life I thought I would get when I got the things that money could buy. As Eric Clapton said in his talk, he said, acquisition is not where it's at. So I was driving home, and I had this big hole in my gut because I realized that I had done something those traditions talk about. I had lent my name to that company. I'd lent my very identity to that company. Anybody else left a job like that? You know, where you've just fully identified and there's this hole right there. Well, I still didn't drink. 9/11 came along. I'm over in Alabama. I'm working on doing a program thing. I'm working on starting my own business. And 9/11 hits, and I realize that my industry has just taken a major shift. And I held out for 2 more days. My sister and brother-in-law went off to this German club. I said, no, I'm not drinking. But I knew where their blackjack was. You know, I knew where it was. And so I decided I'd have one, right? And I ended up having 3. Now, I don't drink the whole bottle because I don't like getting caught. Remember the pleasure by sneaking around? 9 o'clock the next morning, I'm at the liquor store. Liquor store don't open till 9:30. I sat and waited. Who's running my life then? King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm. And I started this cycle again, going up and down, and came to Thanksgiving of 2003, and I was over in Birmingham, whole family there. Told you, we get along great. Everything's going great. But I start getting restless, irritable, and discontent. They don't have what I want in Birmingham. They got it in Atlanta. I make an excuse. Got some clients I got to work. Don't have clients I got to work with. But I get me a little beer, and I go driving back on 20, and I go, don't think about what you're doing. La na 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 na. Anybody done that one before? all the way, 3 hours doing that stuff. And I get into, go to a strip joint, then go to a massage parlor. 4 days later, I have 105 degree temperature. I'm sure I've gotten some sort of sexually transmitted disease or something. It breaks, and then all of a sudden, I start something very crazy. I start passing gas and debris when I urinate. That's in December. In February, I go to the doctor. Wishful thinking. Anybody else done a lot of wishful thinking? You know? Now, I go there and do a swab test, but I got it. Now I'm drinking all the time. I got a drink to drive over there. They want me to do a pee test. I say no, because that means you're going to take my solution away. See, if I'm an alcoholic, alcohol's not my problem. Alcohol's my solution. My circumstances are my problem. In fact, I was cutting every thread I had connecting me to the world around me. You guys are just too difficult to manage. I can work with a computer. I can repair this. In fact, I think I can put on my resume capable of conversing with inanimate objects. So I didn't really tell him what was going on. And now this doctor, I get up to May and I go in again. My wife says, there's something wrong with you. I don't know what it is. So I go in and I finally tell him what's going on. And he goes, oh, you're self-medicating. Well, let me tell you that again. You're self-medicating. I feel this way. I want to feel this way. I'm going to prescribe the solution. I'm going to go fill out the prescription. I'm going to go buy the prescription. I'm going to take the prescription. I eliminate the middleman from the whole deal. You know, one guy said that we should go to veterinarians because they're used to treating patients who won't tell them what's going on. And in July, my wife sends me a letter. We're living in the same house, but she's sleeping on the couch, or a thing she called the cloud. She put a mattress down, and she wasn't sleeping with me. And I'm sitting there. I've been smoking cigarettes for 8 to 10 years, and she doesn't know it. I'm hanging my head out the bathroom window at 25 years married and 47 years old, acting like I did when I was 12, when we used to sneak out at night and go meet around the Coke machine at the trailer down at the neighborhood. But she writes me this letter, says, I don't know what's wrong with you. We may lose the house. If I get another one, you may not be invited. That got my attention. So I told her that I had made an appointment at Kaiser for their behavioral services. I had not made the appointment. August the 9th, 2004, I took my last little squig of Barton vodka at about 2:30 in the morning. And I got up, had my cigarette hanging out the bathroom window, came walking back into the bedroom, and something happened. I said what I call the three-word prayer of an atheist, and I said, I need help. And I fully conceded to my innermost self that I could not do this by myself. And I said, because I was sitting there thinking, okay, how can I lie about this one? I'm trying to make up another lie. And I feel like an old Ed Sullivan show. Only a few people in here remember Ed Sullivan. But I used to have a guy on there who would spin these plates on these sticks, and you had to keep them all going like this. And I felt like I had all these plates spinning. And I got tired of lying. Is anybody else tired of lying? Doesn't it take so much energy to keep a lie going? I was just tired. And I said, well, what am I going to tell the truth about? And I said, everything. Sorry, folks, this is not in the big book. I didn't know about the big book, except it had God in it, and that meant it wasn't for me. But I woke her up, got my daughter off to school, woke her up on the couch, and I just said, this is a quote, I've been a son of a bitch. And I basically outlined everything I've been doing except the smoking cigarettes. And this was mostly out of kindness. My wife hates smoking. Her dad's a cancer surgeon, okay? He's recently passed away now. But but she just hated it. Now, I had 2 cigarettes in my pack. That was the last cigarettes I've smoked. I didn't quit because it was good for me. I quit because it was a lie. And I didn't even really quit. Let me tell you what happened that day. I decided to start being a good father. When I look at the things that a good father does, drinking's not on the list. I wanted to start being a good husband. When I look at what a good husband does, you just heard my story. Drinking's not on the list. Now I get to be a good grandfather. Had our second one born, 9/11. And they said, what a terrible date. I said, no, that just changed that whole date. See, because today, it tells us in the 10th step on 84, it says we continue to watch. Isn't that a great idea? Continue to watch. What am I watching for? I'm watching for loaded words like problem. I'm watching for loaded concepts like, isn't that a terrible day for him to be born on? I've learned, there's a lady who said, the universe is not composed of atoms, it's composed of stories. In fact, we have a story about atoms. 6th century B.C., Greek guy, he said, take a stick, cut it in half, cut it in half, cut it in half. Eventually, you got to get to a point where it's indivisible, and that's what atom means. 1800s, we come along something that looks like you can't break it in half. Call it an atom. I don't think we can break it in half. But you see, it's a story. And in fact, if somebody showed me an electron microscope and said, that's an atom, I just have to believe their story. You see, what's very interesting is there's a group that's been trying to figure out, there's about artificial intelligence and computers, and they figured out there's one complete area we haven't even touched with computers, and that's called analogy or metaphor. Think about the jaywalker. How would you teach a computer to recognize the similarity between an alcoholic and a jaywalker? And yet they started looking at it, and all of our words are metaphorical. If you start going back to the roots, you look at the etymology of all the words, they're stories. You know, the entire universe is between my ears. Everything I know about the universe, that's the only place it can be, is between my ears. Now, you guys are largely theoretical to me. You know, you might exist. I'm going to assume that you exist, okay? Right? But I don't know what it's like to be you. You know? I used to think I knew what it was like to be you. And I don't today. But I have a story. How accurate is it? I don't know. You know? But this is the beauty of this program. Each and every one of you is a metaphor. Each and every one of you is a parable in this program. Jesus taught in parables for a reason, I think. But each and every one of you, each and every one of your stories, to me is a parable. I learned so much more from your story. So what happens then is I start writing down a list of all of the things that I need to do. I've still got that list. It was 5 pages long. You know, I finished most of them after 17 years. But I think there's one or two left in there. I may not have finished. So I went to the doctor, and let me tell you what it was. The strange thing going on in my body was diverticulitis. And I had fistulas. And what that means is my colon and my bladder were stuck like this, and there were slits going between them, passing debris. Only one problem. The doctors knew what was going on with me. They had only one problem with my diagnosis. I wasn't dead. Because that's just like a gunshot wound to the belly. They had fused completely sealed together. I became a retired atheist during this program. And so I go down, and I finally go into to the behavioral services psychiatrist, first one I'd ever talked to. And let me tell you what, I had anxiety and panic attacks. I had problems filling out forms, doing any of that. I just got where my hands would shake and just anxiety attacks. Well, my wife said, can I go down there with you? And I said, no, you go on to work. I can handle it. But I forgot about, believe it or not, I forgot about doctors and forms. And they gave me 14 pages of forms. And let me tell you about fear, okay? I just started going like that, and my hand shaking, and by page 14, I was, you know, going through it. We go through it, you know. Anybody see Search for Spock, the movie? And they got the Klingon holding on to Captain Kirk's ankle, and the planet's falling apart. And he's kicking in them in the head, and he's saying, "I have had enough of you." And that's the way I was with fear. I have had enough of you. So I went to behavioral, so she said, well, we got it. Can you make it to an appointment at 1 o'clock? Now here I was a guy that used to have the pager, the Outlook, you know, the whole deal, and there were people trying to get time on my calendar and all this stuff. I got nothing. My slate is wiped clean. I got no agenda. I've been sitting at home reading all these books. I finally ran out of books, read my wife's romance novels. By the way, guys, if you want to know what standard we have to live up to, read a romance novel. And then we can talk about fear, because I don't think you're going to match up to it. In fact, I had a guy I was sponsoring, and he was having trouble with his wife. I said, "What does she read?" He said, "Romance novels." I said, "Well, read one." He said, "Which one?" I said, "Ask her." And later on, he called me up, and he's sponsoring the characters in the book. You need to let go of your resentment, you know. And today they're still married. They lost their house. He's now programming routers for Google in some of their main offices. Okay. I've seen some amazing things happen here. So I go into that 1 o'clock appointment, 14 more pages of forms. I get in there and there's this guy, and up on his bookcase, he has all these Eastern books. Well, that's interesting. So I give him all the information. He says, "Anything else?" I said, "I have a little problem with this God thing." He said, "Well, you were reading the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People while I was drinking," by the way, which I think is very funny. I was anything but an effective people at that time. By the way, I still have that book by my bedside. I highly recommend that. That is so well in tune, because he talks about we can have different centers in our life: friends, family, possessions, work, church. Could be any one of those. And all of them will suffer if that's my center. But his idea is if I'm principle-centered, then all of those others are improved. If I'm centered on any of the other ones, then all the rest of them besides that one will suffer. It's very, very much in line with this program. And very well-loved book for a great reason. But anyway, he said to me, in there they talk about natural laws. And I said, "You mean like gravity?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Why don't you treat these principles like gravity?" I continued to do that. I had an aunt, my mom's sister, and at 60 years old, she lost her husband. She had to go in and find a job. She found a job as a secretary for the Archdiocese of the Methodist Church in Little Rock, Arkansas. And so she was there until she was 85 or so. You know, I come from some long, long age stock, you know. At least on the women's side of it. I don't know about the guy's side that much. But anyway, the pastor who worked with her all these years is up doing the eulogy, and I'm sitting in the audience there in Little Rock, and he goes, "You know what she said to me one?" We came out of this Sunday school class where we've been talking about the Canaanites and had the map of Israel and all this, and she's like this to him, and he's about like that. She looks up at him and says, "You know, Pastor, I think we're going about this all the wrong way." He said, "Well, how so? What do you mean?" And she's, "Well, I got it boiled down to just 2 things." "Oh, yeah, what's that?" She said, "Reliance and obedience." And I went, "Man, I come from good stock." You think about it. Reliance and obedience. I don't even have to understand them. It doesn't say understand them, dissect them, figure out why they work. It's only reliance and obedience. So I started going there. And I'll tell you what happened was interesting is that I walked into 8111, because let me tell you what, I wasn't going to go to AA, but it was on the syllabus. I had 250-something hours of college credits. I know how to do a syllabus. You know, okay, fill it out, go to the library. I don't just, you know, do it. So I go into 8111, and what I see on the wall, the traditions. I'm an old contract guy, remember? That's a contract with us. And I look at those traditions. You know what they did? They removed every single objection I had to belonging and becoming a member of this program, one by one. And I'll tell you what I found out later, is that those traditions, when I practice those traditions in my life, it's amazing the difference that it makes. First of all, the goal is unity. An alcoholic in our cups is one of the loneliest creatures on earth. You ever felt that? So the solution is unity. In fact, for me, I don't exist. I don't exist as an individual. I'm so deeply interconnected with everything around me. I didn't make these clothes. I didn't create this language. I didn't even pick the country or my parents. Where I end and you begin is very vague for me. You see, and that's the great illusion of alcoholism and sitting there drinking and depression. All those things are this illusion that I somehow am an entity. I like this guy who said, I don't have life. I am what life is doing right now. For other people, you could say, I am what God is doing right now. Might as well make a good show of it. I can crawl around or I can dance. I got a choice. Viktor Frankl. Anybody know about Viktor Frankl? Viktor Frankl was a trained Freudian psychiatrist and Jew. And he wound up spending World War II in Auschwitz. And he was they were doing experiments on him and all this, and he was in his darkest moment, and he realized there was one freedom they could never take from him. And that was the freedom to choose how my circumstances are going to affect the quality of my life. Is it possible that the quality of your life has nothing to do with the circumstances? In 2009, I was at the Woodstock of the South in Sandy Beach. Is anybody familiar with Sandy Beach? Sandy Beach was there talking about the 10th step, and he said, whenever I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. And he said, what's wrong with me? You're disturbed. Oh, okay. Got it. He says, well, there's two things you can do. Okay? If I'm wrong, I make amends. If the other person's wrong, I forgive. That's all? Yeah, that's it. That'd work, wouldn't it? He also said, why do we choose forgiveness last? Why wait and go through all of that stuff in order to forgive? Well, what was happening is my mom's lung cancer had come back, and she was fading away. And I decided at that point not to plan my grief. I had been a caregiver, remember? Well, in 2004, when I first got sober, I found a little ad in a Good News newspaper, and I started doing non-medical home health care. Started taking care of the elderly one day a week. Back doing that. I watched people 94 years old. Old guy, Bailey, had the last lucid conversation on earth with him. And he said to me, he grew up, he had to quit school at 8 years old to go back and work in the cotton fields in North Forsyth County. But he came down to Atlanta and he worked for a guy named Ernest Barrett. But before that, he drove a truck for Red Rock Soda that got bought out by PepsiCo when he got stock in the 1950s. And he was a frugal man and he kept that. And there he is, he says, you know, I got the ladies coming to take care of me in the evening. I got you coming to take care of me in the morning. I said, not bad for an old plowboy. I think we can all do that tonight. You can lay your head on your pillow tonight and look back and say, not bad. You know, not bad for an old converser with inanimate objects up here. Let me tell you what, my mom, as her physical body started going down, and my spiritual awakening started happening during that time. She knew something. See, she was born again Pentecostal. She knew where she was going. I just sometimes tell her, don't hurry on to off this, you know, mortal coil too quickly. You know, we're just enjoying. But I got to be there with her. I play guitar, so I'd bring my guitar down there. And one of her songs, I sang a cappella first as we were driving back from Walmart one time. And it's, I just don't look good naked anymore. And she does love that. So I also play, I come to the garden alone, you know, or, you know, and just her, and just sing there for her and be there with her. On the day of the viewing, I'm in the room and there's this vehicle my mom rode around in, an open casket. And I got my guitar there because my mom liked my guitar. And in comes a lady from her church, little four-year-old girl clinging to her, can't have fun here. This isn't McDonald's playground. Can't have fun here. And I looked at her and I said, can I sing you a song? And the little girl went no, and mama went yes. So I sang a Marvelous Little Toy. And then Baby Beluga in the Deep Blue Sea. Any Raffi fans out here? And then she got down on the floor and 5'2", eyes of blue. And then don't mess with my blue suede shoes. Right here in the room with the coffin. And my mom's natural state of being was to be of service. I knew service was the answer when I was drinking. That little girl gave me a high five leaving out of there. And I'll tell you what, if I had ever tried to plan my grief, I would never, never have written that story. It would always have been about sad and me losing and everything. It never would have been that story. This program taught me that story. This program taught me that I've never had a bad day in AA. My bad days are over with. All I need is reliance and obedience. And I need to awaken. I need to watch my own thinking. I don't use loaded words. I don't use pissed off. I don't use jerk. I don't use any of those words. You know, and I play a new game. It's called, what's the best quality story I can say about this situation? And you know what? I live a pretty rosy life. And I find some people, it disturbs them a great deal. They just believe that it can't be true. It can be true that this program works as well as it does if I employ it. They believe it can't be true. I'm sorry. I'm not going to suffer and go through a lot of pain and suffering just to, so I can have an interesting story. I'm not going to do it. This last weekend, I was down in Jekyll Island with my daughter's family, my 10-year-old grandson. We caught 450 pounds of bull reds. And I only needed one. I caught one, the last one. I just got to watch them while I'm filming it, and I watched them just have a grand old time. See, I'm now a dad. I'm now a grandfather. My new definition of success is this one. What principle applies right now, how can I best implement it? What principle applies right now, how can I best implement it? This thing is not out of reach for you. You have that same choice that Viktor Frankl had. The circumstances of my life, you see, that's why my life was unmanageable. I thought I managed the circumstances, get them right, and then I'll be happy. That's a losing game. That's why my life is unmanageable. I had misdefined it. Today, I'm not a seeker. I'm an explorer. Because if I'm seeking, everybody I meet is either on my side, in my way, or inconsequential. But if I'm exploring a jungle, everything I see there is something worth living. Everybody in here, I'd love to get to know each and every one of you. Each and every one of you are some of the most amazing matter on this side of the universe. We're sending out probes looking for something like you. Really? May you find astonishment in this life. Thank you for letting me share.